And raise your hand. We do have a few on cards that I think I'll give to you. You can answer. You want me? You'll stand here and I'll ask them? You want me to ask them right now? Should we start with these? All right. I guess I get to read them. Okay. Oh gosh, okay.
If I'll give a prize to anybody that could get her to have a red face.
Oh, that. Guess what? Y'all are going to win. The face is already red.
Why is it? It is funny, though, isn't it? What is it about when we talk about the subject? It's almost like people can't talk about it without being embarrassed.
Seriously.
That's a cultural shortcoming. It doesn't need to be a Christian shortcoming. We want to avoid the raunchiness. I got to say a quick thing about this. My area of doctoral study was on the problem of evil, C.S. Lewis and the problem of evil. The Christian understanding of evil is that evil and good are not opposites. Evil is a perversion of the good. Evil compares to good like bread mold compares to bread. And even humans can take bread mold and make something good from it, penicillin. And we should at least believe God could take the evil in this universe and be at least as creative as humans are and bring good out of it. But have you ever heard people say, well, you know, you can't really know good unless you know evil? That's balderdash. That is not Christian. Christian is good is primary. Evil is a perversion of the good. And sometimes what happens is in our culture, we've gotten so off the rails that this has left our conversation. And it's sad to me. It's sad to me. But still, there are parts of it that are funny. Okay. There you go.
Like me turning red. Anyway, no, that was awesome. Thank you. That is so good. Okay. First one, could you talk a little about the harm the purity culture has had?
The what?
The purity culture, or like the purity movement.
Yeah.
Are you in the 90s, yes. Had on Christian sex. And then there's a couple other questions here. How do you overcome the shame of sex? And is masturbation okay?
Okay. I don't know enough about the purity culture to say anything. I don't know enough about the purity culture to say anything about it. I think people should stay pure before they're married. I believe that. I believe if you haven't, that's not the end of the day. God is good he's in the recycle business and so on. So, I was messed up before I became a Christian, but I never had sex till I got married because I had a girlfriend in high school and she dumped me for an older guy and he took advantage of her. And I said to myself, even as a non-Christian, that was wrong when guys do that to girls. And so I just steered clear of that stuff. But I was pretty eager. Matter of fact, I'm old now. And I think about death now like I thought about sex back then. You know, well, what's that going to be like? My word. You know, so anyway, I didn't get involved in that, in the sexual world when I was young. But the purity movement, I don't know anything about it, but I would say everybody should try to steer clear. And why would you steer clear? First off, because you believe the omniscient God who said to you, steer clear, has hardwired us for that. And if we get distracted, we could mess ourselves up. Okay, so that's one. Okay, the second one, how do you overcome the shame of sex? I think you try to, one, confess your sin if you have sin. If you have something that was shameful, confess it. Learn new habits and enjoy it. You should be enjoying sex. God gave it to us for pleasure. He gave it to us for our good. And don't be ashamed of it in that sense. And it may take some rewiring if you've been ashamed of it. You could be ashamed of it because somebody shamed you about it. I know I've done a lot of pastoral counseling. There was this one woman, these are sad stories. This one woman who told me that she was ashamed even to French kiss her husband. Because her father had shamed her. Every time she went out on a date, she'd come home and he would shame her and make, what did you do? You know, and she had to give an accounting to her father about everything. And then I had another woman who one time she told me, I've been married 25 years. I've never had an orgasm. And it just broke my heart. And it broke my heart in a sense for her husband. I'm sure her husband wanted to have her be pleasured too, but he didn't know how. And here we lived in a subculture, a Christian subculture, that should have never been so in a Christian subculture. They should have had people they felt they could go to and talk about this, and they should have learned. Is masturbation okay? Okay, so now I'm going to clothe myself to you, okay? I never had sex, but I discovered masturbation when I was about 11 years old. And I didn't know what that was. I was getting ready to go to bed. Little boys play with themselves, you know. I had an erection. I rolled over when I thought I was going to, the head of my penis rubbed against the sheet. I go, that felt kind of good. So I grabbed the sheet and I start going like this with the sheet. And all of a sudden, something happened and I didn't know what it was, but it was really good. And I had a very sad childhood. So this became my drug of choice. And I was a lean, mean masturbating machine. And I didn't even know about sex. It wasn't until I was in a junior high health club and they pulled down these two charts. And there was female anatomy, there was male anatomy. I had a sister and a mother, but we were pretty discreet in our home. I never saw anything in my home. Here are these two things, and I thought, well, that's interesting. Wouldn't it be interesting to put that over there? And all of a sudden, the light goes on. So now I'm masturbating, and I'm thinking about making love to somebody. And so I become a Christian. I want to follow Jesus. I was serious about my faith. I have been serious about my faith since the day I came to faith. But I'm masturbating all the time. And I'm thinking to myself, and it was a drug, you know. So I go to my college pastor at my church. I'm an athlete, you know, I'm playing football and stuff like that. I go to him, I say, so I need to know from the God guy, is masturbation okay? He gulped. People weren't even talking. I'm old. People weren't even talking about this back then. And he said, Jerry, you're an athlete. Just don't do it. So I said, okay, that's what the God guy says. I'm not doing it. And I just went cold turkey right then. 5 years till I got married. Never once had any kind of sexual expression whatsoever. So I become a youth pastor and I tell the kids, hey, I didn't do it. Don't do it. So it's very self-referential advice. But it wasn't thinking about the complexity of this thing. Men have cycles like women have cycles. A male cycle, day one, you can hardly think about anything else but sex. Day two, you can hardly think about anything but sex squared. Day three, you can hardly think about anything else but sex cubed. And then it levels off at that level. What I discovered when I had those years where I didn't masturbate at all, about day 7 or 8, I had a wet dream. And a wet dream, a man's dreaming, he's making love to somebody and he ejaculates in his sleep. And I did nothing. It was all involuntary, but it happened with regularity over those 5 years. And you're visualizing somebody. Maybe it's somebody you know in a dream. Maybe it's somebody in a crowd you don't know. Maybe it's a famous person in the culture. And so on, you're making love to that person. So I started thinking about this. And then I started thinking about the whole issue of lust. So the Greek word for lust is epithumia. Thumos is the Greek word from which we get the word thermal. It's heat. Epi is upon, on, at, or by. It's getting heated up about something. It's trying to make something happen. And the way you can kind of understand what lust is you look at the passage that says Jesus lusted. It says, epithumia, it was time for the Passover, and Jesus says to his disciples, I desire to eat this Passover with you. Go prepare it. Go do it. Go make it happen. Paul, when he uses the word, he says it in Philippians 1. I desire to depart and be with Christ. I am going to finish well in this Christian life. And he's being intentional about making it happen. Lust is not thinking about something sexual. If it was, you're going to have to cut out all kinds of passages of Scripture. Every college guy knows this passage. Enjoy the breasts of the wife of your youth. Whatever you do right now, don't think about an elephant. Don't think about an elephant. Get the concept of elephant completely out of your mind. How does a person read that passage and not think about breasts? You read the passage about Ur and Onan, Judah's kids who married Tamar, and it says they ejaculated their seed on the ground. How do you read that and not think about sex? How does a woman read about circumcision and not think about a penis? You know, we've so over-sanitized our thinking that we're not thinking accurately. If you see that there's a woman, as a male, maybe for a woman, you know, you see some, my wife says, hunk or hulk or whatever, hunk, a hunk. I don't know what she calls it, you know. I don't track with her on how she thinks about these things. But you see that you're at work and they hire a woman and she's sexually attractive. You say, wow, she's sexually attractive. That's like noticing she has a red dress on or you have a black sweater or something like that. And say, so that's nice. Is that lust? No, I don't think so. But if every time she has to go to the water cooler, all of a sudden you're thirsty and you go to the water cooler, because who knows where those conversations might go, that's a lustful act. Because you're taking steps to see if you can make something happen. So I had this young man, he came to my office one time, knocks on the door. I didn't have office hours. He was one of my advisees. He wasn't in my class that semester. I didn't have him in class. Hadn't seen him in about 6 weeks. I opened the door. He looked horribly disheveled. I said, you don't look very good. He says, I'm not well. I'm seeing a psychiatrist. I'm on antidepressants. I'm seeing a psychologist. And I wanted to come see you. I said, sit down. What is it? He says, lust. It's controlling my life. I'm obsessed with it. It's just eating away at me. And I need to be set free. And I knew this kid pretty good, but maybe he was living a double life. I didn't know. And I said, tell me. He didn't seem to me the predatory type person. I said, tell me about this lust. You know what he described for me? Normative sexual desire for a horny 20-year-old college guy. I said, that's not lust. That's sexual desire. I said, are you a sexual person? He didn't know how to answer it. He was ashamed to even answer a question that should have been answerable for him. He says, I said, listen, it's like asking you, do you have blue eyes or brown? Are you a sexual person? Finally, he goes, yeah, I guess so. I said, who made you that way? He said, God? He never even had that. He never connected that. I said, yeah, isn't it cool? Isn't it really cool? When was the last time you thanked him for it? He said, well, I've never thanked him for this. I said, well, let's start there. So we put it in God's camp rather than some other camp that you picked up somewhere. And then after that, I said to him, where did you get the idea that to be normal was wrong? And he had heard a sermon from a well-meaning but misguided pastor who said, if you notice a woman sexually attractive, that's lusting after her. That's not lusting after her. And so now he thought if he went out in the culture, he had to basically go around with his eyes closed. There were a bunch of Pharisees like that in Jesus' day. They were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. Every time they saw a woman in the marketplace, they'd close their eyes and they were walking into poles and walls and all this other stuff. That's nonsense. Instead, you learn how to put bit and bridle in this thing. So I told him the story. Have any of you read The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis? So he's got these people who are in hell. Lewis counts among them. It's sort of Lewis's satirical Divine Comedy. He finds himself among them, and he's on this bus, and he goes up to the threshold of heaven. They're shades. They've denied reality. They're diminished by it. They've denied that God is God. So they get out, and the reality of heaven and the grass is like nails, and it hurts them, and so on and so on. All of the people are confronted by somebody who comes out of heaven to talk to them, and they have to let go of something they're holding in God's place. And this one guy has a red lizard. They all, by the way, won't let go. They get back on the bus and go back to hell, all of them, but one. He's got a red lizard on his shoulder. And Lewis says explicitly, it was lust. And the red lizard is guiding this guy and telling him what to do. And this burning angel comes out of heaven and says, are you off so soon? And he said, well, I can't be here with this. You know, this is problematic here. And the angel says, may I kill it? He said, well, that's a little bit more intense than I was expecting. It's the only way. May I kill it? Well, you're so hot. You're coming close to me. It will hurt me. I didn't say it wouldn't hurt you. May I kill it? And they have this big debate. And the lizard's telling him what to do. And finally, this guy, he's so frustrated. He says, yeah, kill it, blast and damn you, you know. And he throws the lizard, grabs the lizard, throws him down, and this guy falls over screaming. The next moment, as Lewis is describing, he's walking with George MacDonald through this scene, he's describing what's going on. The next minute, there's this real arm that comes up, and another arm, and the once ghost emerges as a solid person. But the lizard also comes back to life, not as a lizard, but as a giant stallion pounding its hoof against the ground, real. And the man goes over and rubs his nose in the nose of the horse, and the spirit and flesh become one. And he goes over and thanks the angel and mounts the horse and rides it into heaven. And the image is basically this. Instead of the lust lizard riding the man, he is able to mount the horse and ride it and control it. And I said to this guy, what you need to do is learn how to put bit and bridle in this drive so it doesn't run off with you. You're in control of it. And we started talking about virtue, courage, temperance, justice, wisdom, and how to manage these kinds of things so he could be at home with his own sexuality rather than being in denial of it. Does that make sense? So I'm not convinced that the masturbation is wrong, but here's the reason why I'm not convinced. I don't think eating's wrong. I think gluttony's wrong. I don't think drinking's wrong. Drunkenness is wrong. So what does that mean? You need to be a temperate person about this. If you're masturbating 2-3 times a day, my guess is that's your drug of choice, and it's a very accessible drug. I don't think that's right. Somebody says, yeah, but you'll have visuals. Yeah, and then I say, but what do you do with those passages in Scripture that supply the visuals? It's not the visuals. It is instead the epithumia, the burning desire to try and make something happen. As soon as you step out those lines, you're in trouble. You need to have some close friends in your life so you could talk about where those things are. You need to be able to talk to your spouse about where those things are so that you are bringing in the check of your own marriage to keep you from going off the rails and these sorts of things. Does that make sense? Yeah. And when it comes to sex, a man can pleasure his wife orally. A woman can pleasure her husband orally. She can masturbate her husband. There's nothing wrong with that within the marriage. Does that make sense? Yeah, there you go. You didn't turn red.
No. Nobody wins. I didn't turn red. All right, these two might be related. So these two
One
questions.
Was written by the husband and one was written by the wife?
I don't know. I don't think so. But they're a little bit similar. So first one is, are you able to share some things you've learned about difficult times you've gone through and how to weather the storm? And then this one, they might not be related, but I don't know. They seem like they could. And then the other one is, how do you get into the wounded healer room? And so I'm wondering if they kind of relate.
Yeah, well, the wounded healer room, I think you have to get through. You got the Goodwill Hunting room.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize something wasn't your fault. You don't have to bear the burden of the bad that other people have put upon you. You may have to bear the burden of learning how to forgive it and learning how to unharness yourself from it by forgiving, grieving, and forgiving.
Sure.
That's you have to do that. So that's a bit of your responsibility. But when it comes to moving into the wounded healer room, that means you have to go back and set right the things that you may have done because you picked up by your culture these bad behaviors that were done to you they were modeled for you.
Mm-hmm.
And inadvertently, you have done them to other people. And we're hypocrites by it because I knew it was bad when it was done to me. And if I'm blind when I do it to somebody else, I have no excuse because I knew it was bad when it was done over here. So when I go back and ask forgiveness and I realize as I'm asking forgiveness, that probably the people who hurt me were also people who had been wounded.
For sure.
So it makes it easier for me to forgive them. It's out of learning how to forgive the person who hurt me that I then move into the wounded healer room so I could be an agent of positive good rather than somebody who's expecting everybody to take care of me.
Yeah.
The person in the dark room, if they're in that dark room and they're not doing anything to set right the wrongs that they've done, they're probably out there feeling they have license to hurt other people.
Do you think people, like, does it go sequentially? Like the Goodwill Hunting room, dark room?
My guess is we slide back and forth sometimes. Because let's say, you know, you're talking to somebody, you see a movie, and that movie has a scene in it, and it triggers something that's long been buried in you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it comes to the surface and you find yourself crying. You're not quite sure why. You go back and revisit it and you realize, well, there's some more thing back here I need to learn. It's not my fault. And it may open your eyes to something that you may have done to somebody else that was your fault. These things are developing in us. I don't think anybody could say, oh, I got it all figured out. Yeah. You know, even like sex, I don't think I've got it all figured out. There's always more.
Okay. What about this other one that I had mentioned? Can you share some things that you've learned if you've gone through some difficult times, and how do you weather those storms? I'm assuming within the context of marriage.
Well, all this stuff about Joseph and that I told you his story and so on, all of that has come out of woundings I've experienced. Mm. And the worst woundings I've gotten were in Christian communities.
I couldn't believe that.
So the thing is, but there's a big mistake we can make. If you're wounded in that community and you begin to assume all Christian communities are wounding, then you've made a mistake. You've over-egged the pudding. Mm-hmm. And Thomas Aquinas said, an abuse doesn't nullify a proper use. Mm-hmm. If I judge any segment of society by virtue of its worst examples, I'm not being fair. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, how many of you heard about, you know, Catholic priests who have molested kids? What percentage of Catholic priests do you think have done that? If it's been one, that's egregious. But I would say it's a small percentage given all the Catholic priests who are around in this world. Maybe if it's 2%, 3%, that's terrible. But that means there's 97% who have given up everything to follow God and serve their fellow man. Mm-hmm. And if I make a judgment, sweeping generalization. If I make the sweeping judgment, all Catholic priests must be molesters, I am now participating in the dissemination of hateful information. And that's wrong. Let's talk about the specifics. This Catholic priest did this. This was wrong. This is sad. Let's help the people we can who are caught in the vortex of that. So Aquinas helps me at that point. Yeah. But the thing was, I was serving in a church. I was the pastor of the largest church in Santa Barbara, California. And it was a church from hell. And if God calls you to go through a purgatorial experience, pray he takes you to Santa Barbara to go through it, because it's a pretty beautiful place. But it was terrible what happened. And I went through a year and a half of therapy afterwards, just trying to work it out. And we had a good therapist. There are really good therapists out there, and there are really bad therapists out there. And if you get one and they're not helping you, leave them. Go to somebody else who's better, okay? You can tell them you're a therapist. You can point them in the right direction. So anyway, we went to this therapist. She was fabulous. And I think I needed a female. I wouldn't have known this ahead of time. But my issues were not with my father. They were with my mother. And so to have a surrogate who was a female was helpful to me. I wouldn't have known about that. I go through this for 18 months and I go, it cost about as much as a new car. But I thought to myself, this is the best that I've experienced. And it was spiritually healing for me and so on. And I go, if this is so good, how come it's not in the Bible? You know what I discovered? It's on every page. I just didn't have the eyes to see it. Have any of you ever asked? David, one of the greatest leaders in the Old Testament, why was he such a bad father? I started asking that question after I went through therapy. And I go back and I look at David's life. And here's Saul's a horrible king. Samuel's told, go anoint one of Jesse's sons to be king, but God doesn't tell him who. That means that information is in there for us. That's a clue that we can begin to engage in hermeneutics to try to interpret that text. So he goes to Jesse's house and he sees his oldest brother, and he's a big strapping guy, and he says, this must be the guy. And God says, no, man looks at the outward appearance. God looks at the heart. He's not the guy. He goes through all of his sons, and Jesse doesn't bring any more boys. And Samuel says, I don't understand this. God told me to come here. He says to Jesse specifically, it's in the text for a reason. Do you have any more sons? Yeah, I got this one. He's out taking care of sheep. He doesn't really matter much. He only got a quarter for his tooth.
Exactly.
He doesn't matter much. He brings David, and David's the guy, and I go, bingo. He didn't have a relationship with his father. He wasn't valued by his father. He wasn't valued by his brothers either. And you begin to see where the hurt is, and you begin to see how God is working in this hurt. He wasn't a good father to his boys. You know, and even Solomon, you see some of this excess and stuff. These are things that are going on in our life and in our world and around us. And so I think that the pain of the bad things I had happen to me. Were you guys at Wheaton when I got fired?
It was around that time.
Yeah, I got fired at Wheaton. A guy was filling out reports about me that weren't true. I was working on my PhD and he was filling out reports. I wasn't working on my doctorate. So right when I got fired, I defended my doctorate successfully and all these people have egg on their face. President of Wheaton College called me in his office. He says, I told you to work on that degree. I said, who told you I wasn't working on it? And then all of a sudden he realizes he had been had by somebody. I got rehired with a raise for $7,000. I thought I should do this with more frequency. But it was a hurtful time. Okay, so this came to me. It wasn't of my creation. It came to me. And a couple things that helped me work through it. Number one is okay, this is what I have to deal with. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm old. So this was years ago. But I'm old and I'm going to be okay. I'm worried not about the trajectory of my life, career trajectory. I'm worried about my kids because they're getting free education. I was a professor. So I went down and talked to the buildings and grounds people and I said, could I get a job mowing lawns with you? They were going to hire me. And the college said, no, we can't do that. You know, here, C.S. Lewis scholar, he's giving lectures. What do you do for a living? I'm a lawnmower at Wheaton College. I would have been okay with that. That didn't bother me. Another college offered me a job, and when the college found out, they fixed it pretty quick. But that was hurtful. So what did I find out in these two hurtful situations, that church in Santa Barbara and this other one? I've never met a non-broken person, but I've met two people I thought were certifiably evil. They were in it to hurt people. Two. That's all. And I realized, Jesus said, pray for your enemies. I need to pray for them. I'm not a saint. My first prayers for those guys were the imprecatory psalms. How blessed are those who bash Babylonian babies' heads against the rocks, you know. I pray, Lord, all my enemies' children will be orphans. You have to sit there for a little bit. Be angry, but do not sin. Okay? Do not let the sun go down on your anger. But I came to the place as I was praying for them that I pray for them regularly. And I pray for them, they're good. And I pray, Lord, don't let them have happened to them from somebody else, the kinds of things they did to me, protect them. Give them the kindness of God that leads to repentance. Lord, bring about to them good because I know you love them and you're not willing for any to perish but for all to come to repentance. Bring them to the place where they could enter into your favor. But you don't go there right away. It takes a little bit of time. So that's what I learned.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Very good. All right, just one last one from the cards. What's the best thing C.S. Lewis said about marriage?
I don't know if it's the best thing, but it's a memorable one. At the end of The Horse and His Boy, have you guys read that one? So you have Erebus and Shasta, and they're arguing all the time. And at the end of the book, it says, Erebus and Shasta decided to get married so they could do their arguing more conveniently. he has some great things about marriage throughout. And even in Screwtape, when you see how Screwtape needles people and tries to work on the weaknesses of people in order to exploit them. And you see what Lewis says and you say, wow, I wonder if I'm doing that. And it gives you pause and it corrects you a little bit. Is that fair?
Okay, so that was it for the written questions. Does anybody have questions? We'll open up the floor. Don't.
Yeah, way back there. Joel. There you go.
Yes.
Wait a minute, Joel.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
What is the right age to talk to your kids about sexual intercourse?
It's getting more and more difficult because the schools a lot of times are feeling it's their responsibility to talk to them the first day of kindergarten.
That's
right. Huh? Yeah. It's sad to me because kids aren't allowed to be children in our culture. Age appropriateness doesn't mean anything. But I think if if something comes up and you see it and your kids are there and you think they may be a little bit too young for this. So C.S. Lewis said this, you can't talk to a six-year-old about sex because a six-year-old doesn't understand it developmentally. If you tell them it's something pleasurable for a husband and wife in marriage, they understand pleasure and they ask the appropriate question for a six-year-old, do you eat candy while you do it? Because pleasure to them is connected with candy. So anyway, if you talk to them, you can be as ambiguous as you need to be to give them the answer they need at that moment. Sometimes they're asking a question and you think, oh boy, you know, we better break out all the sex manuals and stuff. They're not asking for that. They're asking for what a six-year-old might want to know. And if you say, oh, this is something, we'll tell you more about it. Did you ever read The Hiding Place by Corrie Ten Boom? And she talks about the fact that she heard somebody talking about sex sin, and she told her dad about, she heard about sex sin, what's sex sin? And he said, you know, Corrie, when you go with me and we go to the Watchmakers and where was it? They live, not Rotterdam, but were they in Amsterdam? Yeah, and he said, do I have you carry my suitcase? Oh, no, Dad, it's too heavy for me. He said, well, that's one of those things that's like a heavy suitcase. Let me carry it for you for a while. And then pretty soon, when you're old enough to carry it, I'll help you with it. You can answer a question that way. But if the questions persist, then their need to know is greater. And you need to answer them at the level of their need to know. And you'd rather have them learn it from you than on the playground. So I can't answer the question because I don't think it's the same for everybody. I don't want to give you a uniform answer.
Should it be initiated by your child if they ask you the questions? Or at a certain point you say, it's time for me to introduce myself?
When they're young, if they initiate, you respond appropriately. But we had the sex talk with each of our kids when they turned 12. And Claudia talked to our daughter, and I talked to the boys. It was interesting to me, because the two older boys, when I talk with them, they go, really? You know, really? I go to talk to Jeff, the youngest one, you know, the one with the $5 for his tooth. I start talking, Dad, I know all about that. The younger ones, they sort of get it by contagion, you know, but I still had the conversation. I didn't want him to say, I know all about that, thinking that what he heard from others would be good enough. So anyway, if you haven't talked with them by 12, you should probably talk with them, especially on the threshold of junior high when they get all kinds of goofy stuff on the playground. Yeah, that's my impression. It's just one man's opinion. An opinion is based on, Laura? I'm going to go back and change your transcript. No, she gave it to me last night. She said it very well. Opinion is based on probability rather than certainty. It's subject to doubt. Reasonable people could differ in matters of opinion. But this would be my opinion on it. And I didn't live when you're living. I didn't live with all this assault on children that's going on now. So I lived in a little bit different time. You probably have a better understanding of it than I would. So. Yes, sir. Colson.
Outside of the standard passages in the Bible about marriage, so we reference 1 Corinthians 13, you think about Genesis.
Song of Solomon. Ephesians. Five, you go to Ephesians.
What's another good story? Like, what's something that isn't necessarily obvious but really does have a lot to say about marriage? Bible?
Scripture?
Yeah.
Well, you've got all the passages of the patriarchs. You know, you got goofy stuff going on there. You got Abraham and Sarah. You've got stuff with Isaac and Rebekah. Look at Isaac and Rebekah, my heavens. They were both playing favorites with their kids. And they set up some stuff. What should have happened was when Abraham, Rebekah is told that she's got two children in her, two nations in her womb. Twins, and that the older would serve the younger. She's told that from the get-go. Did she not have that conversation with Isaac? If not, then that was wrong. And then all of a sudden, she starts favoring Jacob, and Isaac is favoring Esau. Esau likes the game and all that stuff, and Isaac is ready to compromise the statement of God for a meal. Do you think that's a little bit like an anesthetizing behavior? That's, you know, I'm getting old and blind. Go fix me some food and I'll give you the blessing and we'll transgress God's plan here. And what does Rebecca do? She should have said, wait a minute, we need to have a family meeting. We'll get some popcorn and some hot chocolate and sit around the table, you know, and doesn't do that. So then she engineers by hook or by crook how they can get the blessing from Isaac. And then Esau wants to kill him. And she doesn't say, we need to have a family meeting now for sure. She just concocts something to get Isaac, to get Jacob out of there and send him off to her brother Laban, who is just a paragon of virtue, right? Get him off to Laban's house. And you see all this family system stuff going on. Those are important passages for us. And we can learn from those as well. You have some good ones too, though. You've got, you know, Ruth and Boaz. It's very, very good passages. And you've got some others that are, I think, within the realm of sensitivity. But anyway, is that fair? Yeah. Yeah, we'll go here, okay? Here, you had your hand up first. Lean in it, I think I said. Yeah.
Do you have any helpful suggestions or how to lean into it?
Yeah, well, first off, don't anesthetize. Don't do the thing. We do the thing to ease the pain, right, or to ease the suffering. Suffer. Don't do the thing and process emotionally this sort of pain that you're experiencing. Grieve it. There's grieving that's going on. Let the memories come and forgive as many times as it comes up. Grieve and forgive. You may do it through tears. And you may do it in time, not through tears, but you still have to be deliberate about it. So I think that's the way. Just don't anesthetize, you know, whatever. But that means you have to know yourself well enough to know what are your drugs. What are your drugs? And I think, too, in the process, you can cultivate temperance. There's four characteristics of virtue. It's courage, temperance, justice, and wisdom. Courage, they're all habits. One courageous act doesn't make you a courageous person. And these are the ancient Greeks felt that this was the means to happiness. And in 2 Peter, the same words that are used by the Greek philosophers are used in 2 Peter about these characteristics, that if they're yours and increasing, that means we don't have them completely, we're developing them, cultivating them. If they're yours and increasing, they render you neither useless nor unfruitful. So the first one is courage, their habits. It's a habitual ability to suffer pain and hardship. It's endurance, fortitude, and staying power. It's the ability to stay in there even in the teeth of pain. And then temperance is the habitual ability to resist the enticement of immediate pleasure in order to gain the greater, though more remote, good. If courage is the ability to do the right thing in the teeth of pain, temperance is the ability to avoid the wrong thing even in the jaws of pleasure. And then you've got justice. It's a hybrid in 2 Peter. It's a hybrid made up of godliness, brotherly love, and love. Justice is the one characteristic of virtue. It says my moral development is linked to my responsibility to others. The people that try to unlink it are like Cain. Am I my brother's keeper? You know, and he does egregious things. So justice was seen as the habit of being law-abiding and concerned for the general welfare of one's society. It renders to others their due. It's fair. And then you've got, lastly, wisdom, which is the habit of being careful about decisions we make. It's to seek counsel and advice. Wisdom recognizes I lack and I want to grow. I need more, and I need more than what I have presently. So we can get it from books. We can get it from people. We can get it from learning from our experiences, from our mistakes, and so on. So anyway, I think those would be some things. I don't know if that helps or not. Back here. Shout it out.
Yeah. So earlier you were talking about doing the journaling.
Say it again.
Journaling.
You mean to find where your scratches are?
Historical.
Oh, that's different. Okay.
Yeah.
When you're talking to each other.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's just between the two of you. The greatest source is, where are you curious? You don't have to ask questions maybe you're not curious about, but I would say to you, it would be good if you could cultivate curiosity about your spouse's life, every area. You know, did you ever have a time where you had great expectations that crashed into deep disappointments? Tell me about that. I remember I saw my first football game at the LA Coliseum. It was the Rams playing the Washington Redskins. And I said, I don't know what those guys are doing down there, but I want to do that. And I began to eat and sleep and live football. And my whole life, I wanted this. In elementary school, my mother made me a costume. Did you guys see, it was a Christmas Story where the guy has that rabbit costume? My mother made me one just like that. And I'm at the Halloween party at school, and every time I won a contest, they gave me a girl's prize. I go, this is never happening again. So I got a football uniform for Christmas that year, and I wore football uniform every year at Halloween. But we were out playing tackle football in the fields as kids, and I wanted to play football. We were too poor to go play in any of the youth leagues. So I had to wait till high school. And when I was in junior high, my junior high school was 2 years, seventh and eighth grade. And at the end of eighth grade, they announced to us that junior high would now be 3 years. And I thought, oh man, that's just like hearing purgatory has been extended. So that meant I wasn't going to get to play in my ninth grade year. 10th grade year, I go to my mom, say, well, I'm going to sign up for football. She says, you will never play football. You will get injured. One day you will thank me for this. And I go, oh my heavens, Mom, I've got to play football. I've been thinking about this since I was 6 years old. She said, you will not play football. So I went out for cross country. Do I look like a cross country runner? I saw all my friends playing football. The next year, I went to her and said, Mom, I'm playing football. I'm going to be a junior in high school. I'm going to play football. She says, no, you're not going to play football. I said, Mom, listen, when I go to college, you're not going to have anything to say about it. And if you're worried about me getting injured, if I don't get any experience, I'm more likely to get injured then than I would be now. If you don't let me play, it'll probably be worse for me. And finally, she sat me down, told me all the evils of football, and said, okay, go play. So I went and played. And I didn't get in at all because I didn't have the experience the other guys had. My senior year, we were the worst team in the LA City schools, of all the schools. We were 0-7. We played another team that was 0-7. The LA Times touted the game as the toilet bowl. And we lost 7-6. But the coach let all the seniors start in that game. And I started at middle linebacker, and I had 33 tackles. And he came to me and said, it was wrong. You should have been playing all along, but it's too late. So I go to college and I start right away. And I played all through college. I had a very successful college career on championship teams. But the deal is, it was so hurtful to me when my mom said no. She let my younger brother play right away, and he was first team all city. And I've sometimes thought, if I would have gotten the experience he got, would I have that? But here's what I got from it. Because God is in charge of these things, and he has our good in mind. And my mother meant well for me. She wasn't trying to mess up my life. She loved me. She sometimes did some things that, you know, I think were wrong, but she loved me. And I learned out of that to have an incredibly intense work ethic, because I had to work harder than everybody else. And it has served me well all my life. And it was a gift. But you have things like that in your life. Where were the disappointments? What were the good that were brought out of those disappointments? Learn them. Where were the encouraging words? I go to college, and everybody thought I was academically a doofus. I knew I was academically a doofus. I just wanted to stay eligible. That was my whole academic interest when I went to college. And I had a philosophy teacher who was requiring C.S. Lewis. I was reading C.S. Lewis then. There were only three Christian profs in my college. His name was Michael Pretorius. Let's honor him. I go to his class. I write a paper. He says, I want to talk to you. You've got a mind. You can think. He was the first, I get moved even now talking about it. He was the first person who ever told me something like that. All of you have people in your life who have spoken to you, and by that you should learn that there are people in your life you need to speak to. We play it forward. Find out from your spouse where both the disappointments were and where the joys were. Learn those things. They're emotionally very deep. And if your spouse doesn't ask you one, don't hold it against them. Say, wait a minute, before we pass over this year, there was something that happened here I need to talk about. And you drop your guard and you learn to trust each other and you learn to love each other and know each other. Isn't that cool? And if you don't, that's why you always leave a couple pages after each year, because you might want to go back and revisit those things. See? Anyway, then we got one here. Was there more? Was that okay? Okay. Where can you get more? Well, lots of places. Aristotle, his Nicomachean Ethics, he writes about it. You could go to C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. He has a whole section on the cardinal virtues and the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity. I think I might have a section in this book. I can't remember if I do or not. I've got it in some places. But if you just Google virtue, It's a huge area of talk in philosophy. Jay Wood, who taught at Wheaton College, he was a virtue epistemologist, and he talked about the fact that to be unvirtuous is to lead to moral blindness. And he writes about how virtue epistemology is learning to embrace truth and let that truth seep into you deeply so that virtue could be cultivated in your life. Those would be some good sources. Do you have another one, Peter? You were a philosophy major. Huh? No, I mean, did you have another book to recommend? Here, you could talk to Peter. He was a philosophy guy. Say it again.
He's coming over in a couple weeks. So as you get older, as you grow in your marriage in years, how does sex change? Does frequency change? Like, what about it changes?
I think one of the things, I've had cancer. And it was prostate cancer, and they did some pretty serious damage to me. And I thought, wow, do these things still work, you know? And you figure out how to make it work. I mean, the pleasure is still there, but, you know, you've got to maybe make some accommodation for it. And maybe when you're older, maybe you can't have an erection as readily. But I found out I could give myself shots, and it was worth it. You know, it sounds painful, but it was worth it. Then you find out you can do Viagra or Cialis. You know, they make you feel miserable, those pills. But there's that. And the other thing, too, is as we got older, my wife just, like, started really liking orgasm. So I found there's a lot of things I could do with my tongue and my fingers that were pretty amazing. And she was really excited about it. And you just learn to adjust as a couple because you are married and this is what you do. It's your private life. And you enjoy sex. There's no reason for you not to enjoy it all the way to the end.
How about frequency?
Huh? Frequency is as frequent as you want. And sometimes we have lots of frequency, and sometimes we get distracted by things and we have less frequency. I don't think there's any kind of, this is the overlay, and you have to look at this as the ideal. And if you're not doing this, you feel bad. Or if you're doing more, you go, hey, we're doing more. You know, I don't think that's the way to go. I just think, you know, the frequency is as often as you want. You're married. You can do what you want. But believe me, it will never not be there, if that makes sense. Yeah.
All right. I know. I think we could all stay another hour and ask questions. But, oh, thanks. But for those watching our kids, we probably need to wrap up. Please join me in thanking Jerry again for coming. This has been so great. Thank you so much.